like you to meet a friend of ours who goes by the name of Killer Joe. Picture a so-called hippie or hip cat standing on a corner in a neatly pressed, double-breasted, form-fitting pinstripe suit, a pair of pointed-toed shoes with bold white stitches around the soles, a black shirt, long white tie, a black pencil mustache, and, of course, a very wide-brimmed black felt hat. Killer Joe always has a pocket full of loot, but only the kind that jingles. You see, he likes to play the horses. He is most certainly a ladies' man. As a matter of fact, he is always willing to accept cash contributions from them for any cause, namely his own. The most important thing about Killer Joe that you have to know is that he's very much against manual labor. Killer Joe.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Rev up your support for KBOO Community Radio. Have an old car taking up space? Donate it to KBOO. Your unused vehicle can become music to our ears, powering independent radio that amplifies diverse voices and community perspectives. It's easy and hassle-free. Either visit kboo.fm/cars or call 1-877-KBOO-123. You'll get a tax deduction and the satisfaction of supporting local independent media. Donate your car to KBOO Community Radio today and drive change in your community.
Welcome to Yes Presents Rising Up with Saman Ali, your weekly antidote to the doom and gloom of mainstream news, lifting up solutions that bring us closer to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. This week, we'll get an in-depth look at the Gaza ceasefire, what it entails, and how it was achieved. My guest, Ramzi Baroud, a journalist and writer, will share his insights. Then, food justice activist Leah Penniman joins me for an in-depth conversation linking our environment with the abolition of policing and prisons. It's one of a series of 12 interviews being featured in my new book, Talking About Abolition, just out by Seven Stories Press. Finally, we'll play a commentary by award-winning journalist and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal about the global shift toward the political right. That's coming up in just a moment. Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Palestinians and their allies around the world are celebrating a ceasefire deal with Israel, brokered 15 months into a brutal genocide. The first part of the agreement is already being enacted, with Palestinian prisoners being exchanged for Israeli hostages. Israel is expected to pull out of all areas in Gaza, allowing survivors of the genocide to return to the rubble of their homes. The ceasefire was one of U.S. President Joe Biden's last acts in office, and critics point out he could have pushed for such a deal a year ago, but refused to act, allowing Israel to slaughter tens of thousands of Palestinians. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump is claiming credit for the deal, fueling Arab-American anger with Biden. A new poll suggests Vice President Kamala Harris lost to Trump in the November 2024 election because of the Biden administration's stubbornly pro-genocide position. A few weeks ago, we had spoken with Ramzi Baroud, journalist and editor of the Palestine Chronicle. He joins me now once more. He is the author of 5 books, including These Chains Will Be Broken, Palestinian Stories of Struggle and Defiance in Israeli Prisons. He's also a non-resident senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at the Istanbul Zaim University. Welcome back to the program, Ramzi.
Thank you for having me, Sonali.
So this ceasefire, far too long, and of course, too many people died before it was reached, and yet it was seen as something momentous because honestly, there was still no end in sight. Are Palestinians celebrating, or should we be skeptical? Because it seems as though it is holding and it is in progress.
Absolutely. So let's just try to understand things from a Palestinian point of view. According to UNICEF, about 50 Palestinian children were slaughtered on a daily basis throughout this war, per average, since October 7, 2023. This means that a single day of ceasefire is a day in which 50 Palestinian children are going to remain alive. They will remain on this earth with us, along with their mothers and their fathers and their neighbors and their friends. So there's a great deal of relief in that. It doesn't discount the massive losses, the unprecedented losses that we have never experienced in our history. And it has been a history of repression and violence and apartheid and racism and ethnic cleansing and all the rest. But still, this chapter is the bloodiest, and we hope that it's the last of these bloody chapters before a new chapter of hope for Palestinian freedom and justice would finally be open. That in mind, Palestinians are also celebrating something else. This is the first time in Israel's history, or rather in the history of relations between the Palestinians and Israel, in fact, between Arab nations and Israel, in which we can confidently say that Israel and the United States and the entire Western conglomerate that supported this genocide, including France, Germany, particularly Germany, but also the UK, Canada, and others, have failed to use their superior military firepower to achieve political ends. And a group of people living in total and utter isolation in Gaza, starved, just at the receiving end of bunker busters and massive American bombs and so forth, have actually managed to push the Israeli army out. That in itself, it is something worth celebrating, not just for Gaza, but really the rest of the global South that have always been at the receiving end of American and Western military power.
So you're crediting Palestinian resistance, but what about the role of the power brokers? Because the United States has enabled Israel, and Israel has enjoyed far too much support, open support, moral support, weapons support from the United States, from several European nations like Germany, and even some of its Arab neighbors. And those have really enabled Israel to continue for so long. The ceasefire was really brokered with some of these power players. How do you weigh the role of Palestinian resistance versus the outside power players?
The evidence are just in front of us. We only need to kind of look where we need to be looking in terms of, to answer the question, what finally stopped this war? Clearly, Israel did not care. Israel did not care about the International Court of Justice opening an investigation into possible genocide, and Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, everybody else has been saying it is a genocide, and many, many countries around the world. Israel did not care about even the International Criminal Court issuing arrest warrants for the likes of Netanyahu and his former defense minister. And the United States served as this vanguard, this obstacle preventing any meaningful action or at least a substantive United Nations resolution, United Nations Security Council resolution that demands that Israel should stop the extermination of Palestinians. And they continue to feed them with weapons even after the ICJ and the ICC made their decisions. To the contrary, they actually passed resolutions to punish the judges of the ICC for daring issue arrest warrants against Israeli leaders. The Arabs were of no use. I'm not talking about the Arab people, of course. I'm not talking about any peoples. The international community, as far as nations and peoples, stood on the side of Palestinians. Even majority of Americans wanted this war to stop, and that traction continued to build throughout the months. But I'm talking about Arab governments. They have done absolutely nothing. And to the contrary, they were actually allowing Israel, providing Israel with a lifeline because of what Ansarullah and Yemen have done to block Israeli ships from entering into the Israeli Eilat port. So Arab countries actually came to Israel's rescue, where Palestinians were experiencing a famine. So no one, and I know every country now separately, is trying to kind of take credits. Biden and Trump are fighting. Who's the one responsible? This Arab country, Qatar, Turkey, this and that. Everybody's trying to kind of take a little bit of a share of the, you know, the success of the ceasefire. The actual success of the ceasefire is related to the fact that Israel, and I don't think we have time to unpack all the things that Israel has done to in Gaza, but Israel has reached a conclusive outcome that there can be no way of beating the Palestinian people and their organic resistance and their collective resilience. It's just, there is no way about it. Even when they went with the so-called general's plan at the very end, which is literally the extermination of all of northern Gaza and pushing the population to the south, people remained. They lived under the rubble of their homes and they remained. If Palestinians did not resist the way that they have and they did not show the kind of resilience that they have exhibited, it would have been over. It would have been over for Gaza, but it could potentially have been over for the Palestinian cause, because it meant that Israel is able alone, single-handedly, to determine the political outcomes using its military force. They would have turned against the West Bank, and that would have been the end of the story. Yes, it is the Palestinian collective resistance through and through.
Now, Ramzi, so far we are hearing reports that there was an exchange of Palestinian political prisoners with some with the Israeli hostages, and that Israel is in the process of pulling out troops. How far into the ceasefire agreement is Israel? And can you give us an overview of what the agreement actually means and what it entails? I know obviously it's probably complicated and outside the scope of this discussion, but just the highlights of it.
Absolutely. So the agreement is divided to three phases. The first phase is made of 42 days in which every week within this period, three Israeli hostages or captives will be released, whether dead or alive, in exchange for about 96, I think, 33-for-1 Palestinian hostages, detainees, or captives will be released, mostly in the West Bank. We still don't know some of the details about the identity of the high-caliber prisoners, meaning the leadership of the various Palestinian resistance groups, including the socialist PFLP and others. We know that one of the top leaders of the socialist group, the PFLP, in my opinion, perhaps the most powerful Palestinian leader, her name is Khaleda Jarrah, has already been released in a terribly difficult conditions in Ramallah and was received by her family. So the hope is we will be able to at least sustain and achieve the first phase of that agreement, in which during that time about 600 trucks loaded with badly needed supplies would be allowed to enter through the Rafah crossing, which separates the Gaza Strip from Egypt, to help the Palestinians recoup and so forth. They will include many tents, At one point, mobile homes will be allowed to enter Gaza because, as we know, anywhere between 80 to 95% of the entire Gaza Strip has been destroyed. So there are virtually no homes for people to live, especially during the winter time and so on. At one point, I think 1 week after the start of the agreement, the Israeli military will begin leaving particularly sensitive areas. I'm talking about the Netzarim area, which separates northern and southern Gaza. This would allow the flow of Palestinian refugees back to northern Gaza. Also, Israel will start leaving the Philadelphia corridor, which kind of chokes Israel, the Palestinian side, and cut them off from Egypt. So the first phase is absolutely essential. At one point, negotiations will resume to discuss the details. The details of the second phase have already been discussed, but to kind of add substance to these details to implement the second phase, eventually the aim is to, for the Israeli military to completely pull out of Gaza, and for Palestine or for the Gaza Strip to be entirely rebuilt, a process that will take years. Now, within the Israeli government, there are certain characters like Bezalel Smotrich, for example, the Minister of Finance, who has threatened that if Israel does not resume the genocide and the war after the first phase, he will pull out of the government. But Netanyahu has very few cards here. I mean, by the time that the 42 days will be will be over, Palestinians will be back in their villages and their towns. Yes, destroyed, but the whole idea of ethnically cleansing Gaza, it will be a thing of the past. Also, Palestinians would have replenished their food supplies, their water supplies, and so forth and so on. And we know that there is no way that Israel can defeat them because they have tried and they failed. So what would be the sense or the point of going back to that war, even if it means that the Israeli government is going to collapse? And the main question here is, will Trump be irrational enough to go back into that war and to serve the role that Biden tried to serve and has failed at it over the course of 471 days. From a political point of view, it just makes no sense for no one, but we are living in an age of irrational political behavior. So we are still worried about what's gonna happen in the second and third phase, but we are quite hopeful that we are in the process of recovery and in the process of actually achieving that permanent ceasefire.
Now, Ramzi, there is a habit, unfortunately, on the left to be naysayers whenever it comes to any sort of positive achievement. Many on the, I'm hearing some on the left sort of decry that this ceasefire deal was not a victory for Palestinians. What do you say to that?
Actually, it's interesting you ask this question, Sonali, because I'm in the process of reading this book called Western Marxism. Mm-hmm. And it just talks about this being the typical behavior of the left in the US and in other Western in environments as well. The fact is that they cannot imagine a scenario in which people in the global South are capable of affecting outcomes themselves. Mm. So they did not look with favor on the achievements of the people of Vietnam, for example, and many other environments in the global South, and the anti-colonial struggles and the liberation wars and so forth and so on, as if change, possible good sustainable change, can only happen through the West, whether through the colonial West or through the supposedly leftist anti-colonial opposition within that Western environment. No, people are actually capable of winning and being victorious in many other environments without relying on the goodwill of the Western left. I'm not saying that I am entirely disappointed in the left in the United States and elsewhere, because as individuals, we have seen massive rallies and sustainable efforts, and we have seen some incredible courage from so many communities in the United States and elsewhere. But I am talking about the intellectual institutional West that is now going to go through this process of trying to deprive Palestinians slowly from any potential victory, because it in order for the Global South and Global South liberation movements to matter, they have to fit into, according to Lazzardo in Western Marxism, they have to fit into this category of being the perpetual victim. You know, guess what? Part of the victory in Gaza was not just done by Hamas and Islamic Jihad and other Islamists. The socialist movement of Gaza played a major role, especially in central Gaza. I'm talking about the PFLP, about the Democratic Socialist Movement. They were involved like everybody else in the process of resisting and the process of resilience, and ultimately they were part of that victory. Why don't we talk about it? They are very much at the heart of the left, serving as a model of success. How can the left be very engaged in every possible way in the struggle for freedom and liberation?
Finally, I want to end our conversation, Ramzi, by talking about something that seems to be unrelated on the surface but isn't, and that is TikTok, the popular social media app where you have a large following, has faced a very brief temporary ban and because of legislation that the U.S. Congress passed, the Supreme Court held up, and President Trump undid that ban for 90 days and has put a condition requiring that the Chinese-owned company be sold to or shared with an American partner. There's many, the ostensible reason given is that there's a fear of China misusing information of TikTok users, American users of TikTok, scraping their personal information and using that nefariously. Why do you think TikTok is facing a potential ban?
I think TikTok is facing this ban for the same reason of why other social media companies, especially U.S. and Western-owned social media companies, have been co-opted to really kind of more or less to be play the game according to the same rules that are dictated by the ruling classes. I mean, Chomsky has spoken about this in Manufacturing Consent. He wasn't talking about social media, and that's why social media became problematic, because it does not adhere to the same principles of mainstream traditional media. They can be co-opted, they can be controlled. So now that you have, for example, the war on Gaza, and you have the vast majority of support and awareness regarding the genocide actually happened on TikTok and lesser extent on Instagram and other social media platforms. Thus, the war on these platforms. And in fact, many members of Congress who supported the ban on TikTok actually cited the supposedly pro-Palestinian propaganda on TikTok. They could not afford that. They could not control that. Now, the idea is let's allow them another 90 days, but with the understanding that we need to be part of the ownership, because you own the means of production. Ultimately, you own part of the narrative or the full narrative. And this is really what the struggle is all about. So this is not about TikTok as a company, as a corporate structure. It's TikTok as an idea that cannot be fully controlled by those who make political decisions in Washington.
Right.
So we need to fight against that.
It seems as though the pro-Palestinian content on TikTok was not deprioritized in the same way that it has been on Facebook. You try talking about Palestine and Gaza on Facebook, and unless you use creative ways to fool the algorithm, none of your followers or friends see that content, because Facebook, reports suggest Facebook's algorithm purposely deprioritizes it, and the same isn't being done or to that same extent on TikTok. And of course, Gen Z and a lot of young people are getting their news off of TikTok. There's a huge generational gap in the understanding of what people in Gaza have gone through, because they are seeing Palestinian and pro-Palestinian voices on TikTok. And even, I understand, Ramzi, a lot of folks in young people in Gaza who have had TikTok accounts documenting their lives under Israeli apartheid and genocide, they have young American audiences on TikTok, right? And U.S. lawmakers, including Republicans, have cited that as a reason for why TikTok is facing a ban. Of course, they call it anti-Semitism, but it's just pro-Palestinian
voices. Sonali, this is what the brilliance about how the media worked during this genocide. I mean, Israel has in some strange way done us a favor by blocking all media outlets, international media outlets, from entering Gaza. They did us a favor because it allowed us to have this social experiment. I mean, they also killed something like 205 Palestinian journalists, wounded hundreds more, many of them escaped Gaza. But the social experiment was this: when a nation is left reporting on its own agony, its own collective pain, on its own story, writing its own narrative on a daily, hourly, minutely basis, will the world understand? The world understands what is happening in Gaza because of the Palestinian journalists, because of these social media activists and the TikTokers, far more they could have ever understood what's happening in Gaza and Palestine when the New York Times and numerous others have been reporting on Gaza and the West Bank and Palestine for the last 100 years. So this tells us that reclaiming the narrative for the Palestinians and allowing local journalists to tell their own story ultimately is the best way to access knowledge, whether regarding Palestine or any other context for that matter.
Thank you again, Ramzi. Always a pleasure to have you on.
Thanks, Sonali.
My guest has been Ramzi Baruth. He's a journalist and editor of the Palestine Chronicle. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Educator and food justice activist Leah Penniman, who runs Soulfire Farm in upstate New York, calls herself an abolitionist. That is, someone who works to abolish policing and prisons. Yet, food justice, her main focus, may seem unrelated to abolition, but Penniman sees them as intimately linked. Leah Penniman is the author of the acclaimed book Farming While Black. In an interview for my new book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible, she asks us to imagine restoring people's deep connections to land and growing our own food, and challenges us to ask the question, what if we decarcerated our people and our food simultaneously, relying on the life-giving possibilities of land stewardship, while rejecting the death-making institutions of policing and imprisonment? I'm so pleased today to share this conversation with you for the first time. It's one of 12 interviews featured in Talking About Abolition, published by Seven Stories Press this month. Welcome to the program, Leah.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this country has historically discriminated against Black farmers and disproportionately advantaged white farmers and white-run agricultural corporations. Why is connecting people to land, especially Black people to land, so important for you?
Well, as Malcolm X in Blessed Memory said, land is the basis of revolution, of justice, of freedom, of equality. And so in this country, land ownership, as you mentioned, is so skewed that 98% of the agricultural land value is in white hands. And this is not because Black and brown folks aren't interested in farming. We have a waiting list around the block for our farmer training programs, and most of those farmers are landless. It's because of a history of genocidal violence against Indigenous people, of chattel slavery and all of its permutations, of sharecropping and convict leasing. It's because of our own government's discrimination against Black farmers, and now the land grabbing that's going on under the guise of corporate profit. And So we have a situation where land, which is not only the basis of freedom, it's the basis of cultural belonging, of intergenerational wealth, our capacity to feed ourselves, to build our homes, to have a place to bury our dead and family reunions together, is slipping away. And we came so close, you know, to being able to regain some of that through the Justice for Black Farmers Act and the efforts to reform the USDA. The lawsuits that white farmers brought to bear calling reverse racism have really slowed down those gains that were promised, you know, in 2020 to 2022. And we're not giving up, but it right now is really up to the grassroots. And we're seeing how much the connection to land, when it's rooted in dignity, when it's rooted in choice, not only allows people to think about a way of making a living that is right livelihood and support their community, but starts to heal that generational trauma and give folks a taste of a world that's possible, connected to our heritage, to the earth, and to our own dignity.
And so that's a perfect segue into asking about how you link abolition of police and prisons and the entire so-called criminal justice system, how you link the abolition of that system to food justice.
It's so important because a lot of folks, when they think about these systems of state violence, of police and prisons, don't understand how it's intersectional with other issues. And yet, one of the most powerful illustrations of this I saw was actually a GIS map overlay of the neighborhoods that were the most heavily policed, where there were the highest rates of incarceration in New York City, were the very same neighborhoods with low rates of Black homeownership, with lower educational quality, with lower access to fresh fruits and vegetables, essentially food apartheid neighborhoods. So it's not an accident of history that these very same zip codes that are criminalized and over-policed are the neighborhoods where people don't have access to fresh food, to clean water, to fresh air. These are the same neighborhoods where, you know, factories and waste sites are located. And it's because of a history of racialized discrimination. The beautiful thing about bringing abolition into the conversation is it forces us to widen our lens and ask, well, what are the underlying causes of these systemic racial oppressions? And we have to look at racial capitalism. We have to look at settler colonialism. We have to look at the ways that Black bodies have been seen as only useful for profit, including the profit of private prisons, and the way that, you know, land has been taken away and autonomy has been taken away from Black and brown communities. So that's one lens. I think it allows us to get at root cause. And I think another way that I approach it is, to me, abolition speaks to this really beautiful and important yearning that we have for nonviolent liberation. We don't want in the long march to liberation to be replicating the kinds of structures of violence that caused the problems in the first place. We don't want to be policing one another. We don't want to be imposing our will on other humans or the earth in ways that are non-consensual. We don't want to have to use coercion and force in order to live. And when we look at the food system right now, it's very much based on violent coercion. It's based on the exploitation of farm workers who are often displaced from their homelands because of so-called free trade agreements or war, economic desperation, unfair immigration policy. We look at the way the land is treated under racial capitalism as nothing more than a natural resource to be extracted, and the violence on the climate and the waters. And so when we frame abolition as this yearning for nonviolent liberation, we also have to ask ourselves, you know, in our work, how do we embody democracy, consent, dignity, care, mutual care, loving kindness? And this is very inspiring to me and something that I see as a, you know, a really, really powerful impulse in the rising generation of farmers.
Can you tell me what you have seen happen when young folks, especially young people of color, young Black people, first experience farming in spaces like Soulfire Farm?
So it's been really powerful. My spouse and I came out here with our young children to this Rocky Mountain back in 2006 and expected to be quite alone. And we had resigned ourselves to that because we had bought into this myth that Black and brown folks were so traumatized by land-based oppression that there wasn't an interest in essentially stooping and returning to this undignified way of being on the land. So it was a shock to me as much as it was to anyone else when, after we, you know, officially opened our farm in 2010 and started to get out there doing our youth programs and feeding the community with doorstep delivery, that the phone calls were coming in of folks who were interested in being trained. And this snowballed. I mean, one program turned into two, turned into eight, you know, 10 people coming through a year turned into 2,000. And something that has happened time and again, and I joke about this because my background is in environmental science, you know, biology, chemistry, and so I can do a pretty mean soil chemistry class with cation exchange capacity and binding sites and feel real good about that. But the thing that people are taking away, in addition to these hard skills and that they comment on so often, is this immense healing power that being in touch with the land in community with other Black and Brown folks in a lineage where, you know, we're learning about the proud agrarian heritage, the contributions of folks like Dr. George Washington Carver to our understanding of cover cropping, or the contributions of Fannie Lou Hamer to our understanding of cooperatives and the role of food and liberation. And so folks are saying that this contact with the earth, this contact with heritage, is allowing them to wake up to a future they didn't imagine possible, allowing them to see beyond, you know, the harmful relationship they might be in, or the undignified job they might be in, or the narrative they might have bought that their only future is as a consumer, sort of a cog in this machine, to say, oh, you know, maybe it is possible to envision a livelihood, a way of being that is nourishing to both myself and community. And that's been so profound in its incessant consistency, this healing and this visioning and this opening up of possibility that the land gives us.
And so can you give me some examples or stories of people whose lives have been transformed in ways that they just didn't expect?
Sure. And I think that, you know, there's so many forces at play. So as Soulfire Farm, we don't want to take undue credit. I mean, folks' ancestors and communities and lineages are all at play, the land herself. But it's been amazing to see the alumni from our program take the seeds of what they learned here and plant them in the fertile soils of their homes. So I think of, you know, Karatumbo Cooperative in Chicago, this femme immigrant queer co-op that was growing food and feeding folks through the pandemic so beautifully that I admire them so much, or the Shelterwood Collective in the Pacific Northwest that's doing this re-indigenizing forest management on hundreds of acres collectively and centering disability justice. There's folks in the Southeast outside of Georgia who are reclaiming at High Hog Farm, who are reclaiming Black folks' connection to fiber, which has been really severed after the trauma of cotton picking. And they are growing both plant and animal fibers and learning and teaching, you know, dyeing and spinning and weaving and bringing these arts back to life in their community, and so many more, you know. And so it's been, we like to think of the Soulfire Network as mycelial, where, you know, our job as one tree in the forest is to share our minerals and messages and sugars, you know, our resources, our knowledge through this fungal hyphae network to the other trees in this beautiful superorganism of the forest. And then they use those resources to express in their own unique way, their own locally adapted way, what it looks like to have, you know, a beautifully nonviolent, liberatory effort towards food and land justice.
You talked about racial capitalism earlier. How has that perverted and subverted our connection to food? And how do we completely transform that system of, you know, the corporatized system of food monopolies? How does that naturally go hand in hand with a world without prisons and police?
Oh, that's such a big question. So as you noted, the food system is essentially incarcerated, right, in corporate racial capitalism. And so our seed diversity has been decimated. The land is concentrated in the hands of a few, one racial group, and many of those landowners corporatized at this point. We have workers who are not protected under federal labor laws like the National Labor Relations Act or the Fair Labor Standards Act. We have consumers who are getting products that are devoid of the rich nutrients that those same crops once held because of their growth rate, because of the soils and that they're produced in, the they're overladen with chemicals, transported far distances. And so, you know, there's a huge disconnect between what's on our plate and our own understanding and experience of nourishment. And so we see this this just epidemic of a reduced life expectancy, of diabetes, of heart disease, of kidney failure, and all of these illnesses, both of the body and also arguably of the spirit, that are connected to not having access to that life-giving food. So it's a really big problem. And I think the thing that gives me some hope amidst it is remembering that this, you know, incarceration of the food system, so to speak, is really only a few hundred years old in the long march of history. And so anything that humans can cook up, however harmful, within a few generations, certainly could be dismantled, you know, within hopefully several generations. And it will take policy. You know, right now we incentivize trashing the planet and human lives. You have to jump through hoops and get certified to be organic, but you can go ahead and feel free to, you know, decimate ecosystems without applying to do so, right? And so really thinking about what we're incentivizing in terms of policy. All fruits and vegetables are relegated to this tiny sliver of the USDA budget called specialty crops, even though they should be at least half of our diets, right? And so on that, on the one hand. And then when we look at land and workers, we're really advocating for a wholesale land reform. I mean, returning land to Native folks, making land available to Black and Brown communities affordably so that we can not just be, you know, laborers on a corporate farm, but be in a position of management, of collective and cooperative ownership, and prioritizing what our communities most need. So we'll take political pressure, and it will also take, you know, good old grassroots alternative institution building. It was really beautiful in some ways to see in the pandemic the how well-placed some of these small independent mutual aid networks and co-ops were to pivot and meet the needs of community when the corporatized infrastructure balked at, they were really unable to change at the rate that was needed in order to feed community. So it's this little glimmer of possibility of like, oh, this community created infrastructure actually is resilient, is flexible, adaptable, and can meet needs. So I hold on, you know, I hold on, even though clearly the trend has been to corporatize and to make the food system more violent in the West.
So if the incarceration of land is linked to the incarceration of people, then conversely, the decarceration of land and people need to go hand in hand.
Absolutely. You know, and quite literally, that nasty little loophole in the 13th Amendment that does allow slavery in the case where someone has committed a crime, you know, as defined by the courts these days, it means that predominantly Black folks who are incarcerated can be made to work for no pay. And we see this in, you know, fighting the wildfires in California and the West. We see this during the pandemic with labor shortages in the fields of folks coming from prison and picking vegetables and, you know, picking grains in order to keep the food system running. We see this with furniture companies and, you know, all kinds of corporate entities taking advantage of this. And so freeing the lands, you know, in the food system, it's metaphor, but it also quite literally these systems are intertwined where the prison industrial complex is invested in a corporatized and violent food system.
I want to talk to you finally about the idea of generational wealth. Incarceration segregation, slavery broke up communities and families and severed those ties with the land as well. And then you've had, as we talked earlier, this advantaging of white farmers, land being a way to maintain generational wealth that white communities have been able to pass down to their families. So I'm wondering, however, if we start to rethink food justice entirely, do we start to rethink the idea of wealth, money, you know, these sort of capitalist ideas of land as money, land as financial wealth? Do we need to start transforming those ideas as well?
Oh, that's beautifully complex, right? Because we know that hundreds of billions of dollars at minimum were lost to the Black community through land loss. And again, this was not a voluntary relinquishing of the land. You know, folks weren't paid for their land, but we had an internal refugee crisis when, you know, in the early 1900s, Black farmers were at the peak of their land ownership with about 16 million acres. And there was a backlash from white supremacists in the South who wanted Black people to stay on the plantation as sharecroppers. And the lynchings and the burnings and threatening and driving people off their land was a major push factor in the Great Migration, which displaced 16 million Black folks to the North, to the West, to the urban areas. And so the reverberations of that are felt, you know, psychospiritually and economically, with that intergenerational wealth being lost, while at the same time, it has been accumulated unabated in the white community. And so there certainly are, you know, whole sectors of Black food justice community that are very much advocating for intergenerational wealth, including the wealth of the land and finance vehicles for that. And I think there's obviously a lot to be said for that. And there also are factions in the Black land justice community that are saying, well, you know, thinking about land from a monetary framework is inherently problematic. And so how do we demonetize land? How do we think about collective and cooperative land stewardship versus ownership? And what are the ways we can use, you know, essentially white man's tools of land trusts and co-ops and easements and B Corps and, you know, whatever structures we can to almost soften the enclosure and private property orientation of law in this country. And so at Soulfire, we tend to fall a bit in the latter camp where, you know, our land is held cooperatively and we do a lot of organizing with the Mohican Nation around land return and shared sovereignty. And we've made it, our land would be quite difficult to ever make any money selling this land, which, you know, lawyers throw up their hands at, not understanding why you want to muck up your title. But at the same time, it would be unfair to sort of say, well, you know, white folks get to accumulate all this wealth and Black folks are obligated somehow to think differently about it, right? So it's a very complex issue.
And so that inter-community learning with indigenous communities, between Black and indigenous communities, seems as though it informs a lot of your thinking around food justice and farming.
Yeah, I think it's impossible for any one community to get free by ourselves. And so it's these multi-ethnic, multi-racial coalitions are crucial for us. We think that the indigenous communities globally who are closest to the land and the earth have the wisdom we need to chart the way forward. So that includes indigenous African folks, you know, Turtle Island indigenous folks, Asian indigenous folks, and have spent a lot of time and resource to build those coalitions. We're a member of Via Campesina and work internationally in these intercambios, these exchanges of ideas. But certainly in addition to that, we're also accountable to the people upon whose land we live and work, and that's the Mohican Nation. And so for the past many years, we've built a friendship with the Stockbridge Muncie Band, who are predominantly located in Wisconsin and have worked on seed rematriation projects and interrupting a pipeline development that would have desecrated a sacred fire historical site, and most recently on a 250-acre land return project. So there's a lot going on there, and it's very important to us. And we don't see any contradiction in working for, you know, Black land sovereignty and liberation alongside deep solidarity and commitment to native liberation and native land sovereignty.
Leah, thank you so much for joining us today. Is there a website that you'd like to recommend, any place that people can follow your work?
Well, thank you for having me. Folks can find out more at soulfirefarm.org or follow us on any of the social media platforms at soulfirefarm.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Leah Penniman is a farmer, author, and food justice activist based in upstate New York, where she runs Soulfire Farm. Her books include Farming While Black, Soulfire Farm's Practical Guide to Liberation of the Land, and Black Earth Wisdom, Soulful Conversations with Black Environmentalists. She's one of 12 abolitionists featured in my new book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible, out in January 2025 by Seven Stories Press. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. This week, the United States inaugurated President Donald Trump for a second term, ushering in an era marked by double standards on criminality, the law, and democracy. Trump represents a rightward shift happening across many nations, and today we'll share a recent commentary by award-winning journalist and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, reflecting on that global trend.
A mad dash to the right. As we look at this world, as New Year dawns, we must admit that the world is on the march. And, if we're honest, it's a march to the right. Why is this so? It is so, in my view, because rightist politicians have mastered the art of fear. And the politics of immigration is all about the manipulation of that fear for political purposes. Fear moves us, not hope, nor altruism. For fear taps into our survival instincts. It also draws us to the polling places and makes us vote. That explains what has been happening in Europe and in the US as well. In fact, the recent American election was a contest between love and fear. And guess what? Fear won. In his first inaugural address in March of 1933, former US President Franklin Delano Roosevelt said, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." Well, that was then, 1933, almost a century ago. Today, fear breeds more fear. And fear of what? Fear of blacks, smart women, fear of trans people. Politicians who know about how to motivate populations know well the pull and power of deep emotions, like fear. They use it the way a violinist uses his strings. Many people are so engaged in fear of the other that they don't really see the game behind the curtain. That's because fear disrupts our ability to analyze and think things all the way through. Much of this anti-immigrant hysteria is occurring in Europe, as many refugees from former colonies are trying to make their way back to the lands of the former colonizers' countries. In the U.S., much of the anti-immigrant energy is aimed at Mexicans and other Latino communities. Some see this explosion of anxiety as the fear of a browning of America. Latinos constitute the fastest growing segment of the U.S. population. Europe, meanwhile, is anxious about Arab and African refugees. Remember the lies about Haitians? They're eating our dogs, they're eating our cats, and other pets. Remember that? Of course you do. It was a lie. But it made Haitians the object of fear. How many folks know that the Haitians helped Americans fight against the British in the Revolutionary War? The Haitians were otherized, thus easier to fear. A few weeks ago, I heard a radio broadcast of someone complaining about refugees entering their country with significant anger in his voice. Guess who the speaker was? He was a Turkish citizen complaining about refugees from the civil war in Syria. This shows that the problems are not always as simple as they seem. Over a century ago, Marx said that a worker had no nation, and neither did the working class. As members of a class, all workers were brothers and sisters of other workers. Then they had two world wars, the awesome carnage of those wars, and people were firmly held in the grip of nationalism, still in war mode, but this time locked in a so-called Cold War. The wars had severely weakened several European empires. And during the 60s, we saw a wave of anti-colonial struggles, with many countries winning independence. The Algerian Revolution erupted in North Africa, and France, already weakened by its fall at Dien Bien Phu, or Vietnam, lost Algiers after some 6 years of anti-colonial war and popular resistance. Algerian revolutionary Frantz Fanon called repeatedly for decolonization, not just in Algeria, but in the whole of Africa. In fact, the world must be decolonized. Now, as many of those Arab and African states experiencing flag independence, a term that really means false independence, and those countries being in the grips of neocolonialism, their populations were uncared for and had to flee to find new places to live. With governments failing to serve the needs of their people, they became refugees of states that failed. The capital accumulation that Europe has experienced looked pretty damn attractive to millions of people in the former colonies. This present era is not just one of rightist drift. It's also a time of neoliberalism and the domination of the market. It's not a coincidence that these three features are merging together. For rightist drift, also known as neoliberalism, and anti-immigrationist anxieties go hand in hand. We are not surprised. Markets don't work to make communities better. They work for profit, period. They work to exploit, not to serve. We need to know that so we can organize together against it. Refugees aren't our enemies, only our fears are. And fear ain't nothing but an emotion. Danke, danke sehr. with love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Mumia Abu-Jamal is an award-winning journalist and political prisoner. His commentaries can be found at prisonradio.org. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
It seems like recently the struggle to take action on climate change has gotten more complicated. And there are a lot of solutions that are presented to us that at first glance look kind of good because they have